Web streaming of 90.3 WPLN-FM is made possible by listener support and by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery. Learn how you can support this service at NashvillePublicRadio.org.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle.
And I'm Peter Sagal. It's that great time of the sports year when baseball is heating up and enough time has passed since the NBA season that you can just about forget LeBron James won another ring. So we're going to spend this show on athletic feats without actually moving. We'll listen back to some favorite interviews with track stars, soccer stars, as well as people in sports people actually care about. Plus, our own star athlete, Carl Castle, heads to Coney Island for the hot dog contest.
You going to eat that?
Start stretching now. Our sports show starts right after this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Yemen says militants killed five soldiers guarding an oil installation in that country. The attack comes after Yemen announced last week it foiled an al-Qaeda plot to assault similar installations. The U.S. embassy in Yemen remains closed, even though 18 other U.S. diplomatic facilities around the world reopened today. Voters in Mali are choosing new leaders after last year's coup and the French military intervention to stop al-Qaeda. The leading candidates are a former prime minister and a former finance minister, as the BBC's Mike Woolridge reports.
Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, known by his initials, IBK, has urged Malian voters to give him what he called a clear and clean majority in the runoff. He says his first priority as president would be the reconciliation of the country. He has the support of influential moderate Islamic leaders. His rival in this second round is Soumaila Cisse, a former finance minister who's run on pledges to improve education, create jobs, and reform the army. He's been more openly critical of the leaders of last year's military coup than Mr. Keita.
The BBC's Mike Woolridge. It's a long time until the 2016 presidential election, but possible Republican candidates were in Iowa Saturday. NPR's Dan Bobkoff says they displayed a shift in the GOP's tone.
Former Senator Rick Santorum won the 2012 Iowa caucuses, but his presidential campaign later stalled out. This weekend, he was back in Ames, telling the Family Leadership Summit that the GOP should do a better job connecting with working-class voters. He said the party should reject the idea that if we build the economy, all boats will rise. He said the party needs to celebrate not just job creators, but job holders, saying that many didn't want to vote for President Obama, but at least the president went out and talked to them and about them. Santorum said his party marginalized working people. Santorum was one of a number of possible 2016 candidates at the forum. Also speaking on Saturday was Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. Dan Bobkoff, NPR News.
U.S. wireless company Verizon plans to expand north of the border, apparently with the support of the Canadian government. Dan Karpinchuk reports from Toronto. Canada's wireless providers are getting ready.
Canada's mobile phone service industry has for years been dominated by three companies, Bell, Rogers, and TELUS. But they aren't allowed to buy up smaller companies, mainly because of Canada's anti-consolidation laws. However, those rules don't apply to foreign companies, so Verizon may be on the verge of making major moves in the Canadian market and becoming the fourth big player. Some see Verizon's entry into the market as good for consumers. The three Canadian mobile phone providers don't. They've mounted a big advertising campaign called Fair for Canada, suggesting that profits and jobs will go south and that Verizon is trying to take advantage of an unfair loophole. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Former nightclub and TV singer Edie Gourmet has died. She was 84. She had a solo hit in the early 60s with Blame It on the Bossa Nova. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. With about a quarter of Major League Baseball's 162-game season left, teams like the Dodgers, Braves, and Tigers are asserting themselves. NPR's Mike Pesca reports on these teams' recent winning streaks.
At the halfway mark in the season, the Los Angeles Dodgers found themselves in last place in the National League West. They were a 500 team less than a month ago. But since then, they have gone on an epic winning streak. They are 36-8 in their last 44 games. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, the 1953 Brooklyn Dodgers were the last National League team with that many wins in 44 games. The Atlanta Braves had been riding a 14-game winning streak of their own until it was snapped by the lowly Florida Marlins last night. The Detroit Detroit Tigers, winners of the American League last year, are 16-2 in their last 18 games. The Tigers, Braves, and Dodgers all lead their divisions. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
Officials rescued a teenaged girl from the Idaho wilderness late yesterday and killed her alleged kidnapper. Hannah Anderson had been sought for a week ever since she had gone missing from her home. Her alleged abductor, James DiMaggio, is suspected in the deaths of her mother and younger brother. Hannah is expected to be reunited with her father today. Officials had searched over three states for her before her kidnapper's car was discovered at a trailhead in central Idaho. The huge wildfire burning about 90 miles east of Los Angeles is about 70% contained. Fire officials say they hope to encircle all of it by the end of today. The so-called Silver Fire has injured 10 firefighters and severely burned one civilian. It has destroyed 26 homes. It has scorched about 30 square miles of land. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Subaru, sponsor of NPR's Backseat Book Club. Learn more about this month's book selection at npr.org/backseat.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. You are awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, listen, we know, because we are fans of public radio ourselves, that there is nothing worse than public radio trying to cover sports.
Goodness, he's attained yet another sum of points on the gridiron pitch tally-ho!
Nonetheless, we're going to spend the next hour talking sports, but to help, we're going to bring in some jocks.
And these ones didn't even beat us up. It was the total opposite of high school.
We're going to start with a woman who is not a professional athlete. She just talks to them, sometimes even when they're naked.
We talked to Michelle Tafoya, sideline reporter for NBC Sports in her hometown in Minneapolis in May. She joined panelists Tom Baudet, Brian Babylon, and Kiri O'Connor on stage.
We were also joined by guest host Bill Curtis. And I started by asking Michelle if she was still a fan of the game.
I adored football growing up, but I must tell you, I find that being a reporter is so much easier than being a fan. Vikings fans got to agree with that. It is so hard.
Now, why is that? Because being a reporter seems like a hard job.
It is, but the emotional roller coaster of being a fan, it's just not worth it.
That's an interesting message for somebody who works for Sunday Night Football to send.
But still, tune in each Sunday night.
Well, tonight, Michelle Tafoya, special segment, What the Hell is Wrong with You People?
Michelle.
Welcome back to You Disgust Me with Michelle Tafoya.
So how did you get into the... I am going to guess that it's harder for a woman to get into Major League Professional Sports Reporting than it is for a man. Am I right?
No!
You know what, though? Timing is everything. And I think I sort of followed the floodgates that were opened by Leslie Visser and Robin Roberts. And it had just started to become something that women could do. And I thought, I can do this.
Well, how did you prove yourself?
Oh, gosh. The best advice I ever got was go get a job somewhere.
Yeah.
So I went to Charlotte, North Carolina. I did 5 hours of sports talk radio every day, and that was my...
You did?
Yes.
That is the hardest job in the world.
It was not easy.
How do you talk about sports for 5 hours without boring yourself to death?
One time I was solo, and I found myself reading to my audience out of the newspaper because I had run out of material. But you do that all the time, don't you?
I ran out of material 10 minutes ago, couldn't you tell? I thought I'd bring you on and see what you had. I got nothing left.
But I want to know how you got from there. Well, first of all, so now describe your job. You're the sideline reporter. You're the person they throw down to, as they say in the trade.
Yeah.
And you've got the reports on the sideline. Well, this guy's injured. Well, this guy feels this way.
Right.
That's what you do. Your job is to sort of provide on-field commentary.
Yes, on-field commentary, pre-game interviews, post-game interviews. I talk to the coaches at halftime as they walk in or out of the locker room, and that's always a load of fun, especially the losing coach.
Can I ask you, when you talk to the losing team, do you kind of put on like a nice mommy voice, or do you change your tone of voice?
Gee, coach, really it's not going so well, is it?
Do you do that? Because I've wondered about
that. Do you
have
a minute for me, coach?
Do you do that?
No.
Is that how you approach it?
No. I mean, there are some, you get to know every single coach and how he's going to respond to you in that moment, and you just sort of brace for it. And you kind of just go, all right, I just got to ask my question. I know what how he's going to act toward me, but I'm ready. I'm just going to do it, and you do it, and you get what you can.
What's the worst reaction you've ever gotten in that situation?
I cannot tell.
Really?
Did
somebody drop some profanity on you?
No, I always talk to them off camera because I can get more out of them, and then I come back after halftime and I report to the audience what I've been told.
So you came back and you're like, well, I just talked to the coach of the losing team and he suggested certain things that were anatomically impossible. Back to you, Greg. Is that what you did?
Well, you have to maneuver around that. I mean, because if you sell out the coach, you never get to talk to him again. So I don't want to sell out the coach.
I got to ask you about the locker room. Do you go into the locker room?
I used to much more so in the NBA. And that's quite something.
And so, are these large, strong men in the best shape of their lives naked?
Pretty much, yeah.
Faith wants you to give details. I was just thinking about with the NBA would be more difficult because when you think about what would be at eye level in that situation.
Yeah.
That's got to be awkward. Yeah.
Because I remember, this was now going back 20 years ago when the first female reporters were working major sports and they wanted to go into the locker room and do the same damn interviews that the male counterparts were doing. And some of the players were like, wait a minute, we don't want girls in here.
Yeah.
And those pioneers were like, nope, we're going in, we're doing our job. So is it awkward for you?
Let me tell you about my first time.
Oh, please.
Again, Charlotte, North Carolina. It's the Hornets hosting, because they were then the Hornets hosting the Houston Rockets. There's another joke there, but
wow, the Rockets.
Were they ever? So there you are.
So there I am, and I'm getting ready to go in, and this is the first time I've ever done this, and I'm just going to do some radio interviews for tape to take them back and turn them around. And I said to myself, I had a rule I established before I went in. My rule will be I will only look at their eyebrows. I won't even look in their eyes. I'm going to look at their eyebrows when I talk to them, because that will make sure that I'm focused there and I can never be accused of looking anywhere else. And this was so long ago that the guy who opened the door said, "Lady in the locker room." It was like, you know, lady with a baby coming in. "Lady in the locker room." So everyone's kind of shuffling around, and I make a beeline for my guy that I'm going to interview. And I'm walking up toward him, and his eyes got to be like the size of paper plates, because what I didn't notice was that he was buck naked. I was too focused on his eyebrows.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
And you're charging him.
And the guy... A player sitting next to him says, "Ma'am, could you just turn around and let the man put a towel on?"
I thought, you know, when you turned around, he'd have the towel around his head to cover up his big eyes.
I think one of the most, and again, I won't name names, but I remember doing an NBA game, and I was asked to go interview a player's wife in the stands about something. And I got there, and she came out to stand next to me on the steps there, and she was wearing a very low cut, and she was ginormous, and I couldn't even look at her eyebrows. I was too focused.
Michelle Tafoya, we're delighted to have you with us. We've invited you here to play a game we're calling
Enter at Your Own Risk.
Okay, so you're a female reporter. You are allowed inside the NFL locker room. You're a pioneer, but there are still places out there, Michelle, where they believe in cooties. We're going to ask you about famous men's only clubs.
Okay.
All right. Get two questions right, and you win our prize. Bill, who is Michelle Tafoya playing for?
Daniel Schneider of St. Paul.
All right. Here we go. Ready to play?
Nice. All right, Daniel. I'm going to do my best.
Here's your first question. One of the most famous all-male gentlemen's clubs in London was the Reform Club, with the fictional Phineas Fogg started and ended his trip around the world in 80 days. When Michael Palin of Monty Python's Flying Circus attempted to recreate the feat, he failed. Came close, but he failed. Why? A. While he was gone, the club viewed the classic Monty Python dead parrot sketch and decided Mr. Palin was too vulgar to be readmitted to the premises. B. He got back to London but couldn't be readmitted because he was poorly dressed. Or C. He tried to drive himself to the club in central London but got lost.
Oh, man. I'm going to say B.
You're going to say B. He got back to London but couldn't be readmitted because he wasn't wearing a jacket and tie.
Yes.
You would be right. That's what happened.
Yes! That's so exciting.
He left the Reform Club, traveled around the world in 80 days, came back, ran up the steps, but he was not wearing a jacket and tie. They wouldn't let him in the club, so he finished his journey on the steps. Now, one of the first all-male gentlemen's clubs in America was the Schuylkill Fishing Company of Philadelphia, a club that played a minor role in revolutionary history when what happened there? A. Revolutionary officers hid inside from British pursuers who wouldn't enter because they were not members. B. George Washington himself went on a three-day bender there. Or C. Benjamin Franklin became the first and only member thrown out because of his horrible morals.
My!
I feel like we should be doing play-by-play on Michelle. Right?
Yeah.
It's not pretty.
Yes,
it's not pretty.
She doesn't look like she has it yet.
You can't tell, but I'm diagramming your groping for an answer on the telestrator.
I'm going A.
Is there people saying C? Yeah.
There are people
saying C. All right, C.
Actually, it was B. It was George Washington. The club was famed for its beverage known as Fish House Punch, which, according to legend, was so potent it knocked George Washington out of commission for 3 days. Okay, this is all very exciting. If you get this one right, you will win. Here's your last question. At the Burning Tree Country Club in Bethesda, Maryland, women are only allowed to visit the club when? A. On Women's Day, which is a holiday named after a magazine. B. According to the club rules, quote, at the point in their menstrual cycle when they're least likely to attract bears, unquote. Or C, in December, only to buy Christmas gifts for their husbands in the pro shop.
C.
Yes! Right!
Nailed it. That was all net. That was all net, sister.
Absolutely.
Bill, how did Michelle do in our quiz?
She did great because she got two right.
It's out the fire, ladies and gentlemen. Well done. When we come back, track and field legend Jackie Joyner-Kersee and the great announcer John Miller does a play-by-play of the making of a ham sandwich. Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. Esurance, with a network of repair shops to handle car insurance claims and provide photos of their progress at esurance.com. The National Association of Realtors, an advocate for home ownership. More at houselogic.com/homeownership. And Kobo, creator of the Kobo Aura HD e-reader. Available now at independent bookstores. Store locator at indiebound.org. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Thank you.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Athletes talk about the endorphin rush that tough physical exertion gets you, a kind of naturally induced high. We tried to see if we could get the same effect by just, you know, talking to athletes.
We brought along our inhalers just in case.
In June, we went down to St. Louis, where Jackie Joyner-Kersee grew up, just across the river in East St. Louis. She went on to be the greatest American female track and field athlete ever.
Jackie joined Mo Rocca, Kerry O'Connor, and Brian Babylon on stage, along with guest judge and scorekeeper Bill Curtis. Peter began by asking her if she had always been athletic.
Yes, I was always into athletics, but I really wasn't really good in track because I started running at the age of 9, and my first race, I finished last.
Really? So you weren't one of those kids who were like immediately everybody knew you had a special talent. You had to really work for it.
Well, my coaches might have known, but when you finish in 8th place and 7th place, that ain't special.
No.
I wonder where that kid is who won first place in that race. What is that person?
We read that you actually made your own sand pit to jump in, to do long jump.
Yes.
And that you had to collect sand from all around East St. Louis to make it. Is that true?
Well, not quite around East St. Louis. It was a park and across the street from where I live, and they had a sandbox. And so I would convince my sisters we would take potato chip bags. And we would walk over to the park, and we would fill the bags with the sand and bring it back to our front yard so I could practice on my jumping.
I mean, did any of your siblings say, why don't you just go jump over there? We'll save a lot of time.
See, we weren't supposed to leave the yard.
Oh.
So we would go over to the park, and we never collected enough sand for me to jump in the pit, but you know, I was jumping off. We had a porch and a banister, so I would practice my jumping, and my mom didn't know because it was just a little bitty mound of sand.
I love this story of you guys smuggling the dirt. It's like the Great Escape. These little kids are like sneaking over there holding potato chip bags, trying to look nonchalant. So once you started winning, you know, when did you get on the path to the Olympics?
When I was 14, I saw the 76 Olympic Games on television, and I remember going to my coaches, and I asked them, did they think that I could make the Olympics, because that's my dream. I want to go to the Olympics because I saw women at that time doing what I was trying to do.
Right.
And I was like, wow, well, maybe I can get on TV by going to the Olympics. So that's what I did.
I watched the 76 Olympics. I just said, that makes me tired. I got some more ice cream. But now, I mean, you went to 4 Olympics. I can't even count your medals.
3 gold.
3 gold.
A silver and 2 bronze.
Really?
Thank you.
And a world record that still stands in the heptathlon, right?
Yes.
Okay. So where do you keep the medals in your house?
Well, they're in a safe place.
Yeah. If I were to come over to your house, and I'm not angling for an invitation, but if I were to come over to your house, would I see them? Are they out?
Well, no, they're not out. But
no, really?
Oh, mine will be everywhere.
I was about to say. Yeah. If I had one Olympic medal, I would be wearing it now.
Yeah.
I'd be wearing, this enormous medallion around my neck? Well, that's my Olympic medal.
Yes. With a bowl of Wheaties right in front of
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Yes.
Really? But you don't ever take them out and just go, oh, yeah.
You know, you could, but, you know, when you look at the gold medals or the silver medal or the bronze medal, it's like, oh, all that hard work. Ooh, them 12 hours. Oh, 365 days of the year. Oh, let me put that away.
Your brother Al is an Olympic gold medal winner.
Yes.
Did you go up competitive with him? Did you ever race him?
I did.
Did you smoke him?
I did.
Did you? If your brother were here right now, would he confirm this story?
Oh, yes, he would confirm.
He confirmed this story.
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to say. He wouldn't
but
lie.
But he would also say that he beat me to winning the first Olympic gold medal, though.
That's true.
I'm curious, if you're ever on the way to a meeting and you're in a traffic jam, I mean, do you ever just get out of the car and just sprint right there?
You know what? You have those thoughts, but you know, a lot of times you're going to the means, you got on heels. But, you know, some people run in heels. But
could you do that? Could you sprint in heels?
No, I could barely walk in them, so I know I'm not prepared to sprint.
This is what I want to happen. That's your dream, Mel. My dream is that Jackie is walking down the street and some guy grabs her purse and runs.
Yes. No. Exactly.
That's
the
what
iPhone
I see.
Thing. Like when you walk down the street, because there's all this rash of iPhone thievery where people will snatch out of your hands, and so you know people are really protective, but you can just wave it all around. You don't got to worry about anything.
Can you still throw a javelin?
Oh yeah, I can.
Is there ever reason to?
Yeah, if someone steals your iPhone.
Right. Because, yeah. You know, I got the fold-up javelin in my bag.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Dangerous runner. No. Well, Jackie Joyner Kersee, we are so delighted to talk to you. And we have invited you here today to play a game we're calling...
May Thunder Blast Your Head.
So your name, of course, is Kersee, but how Kersee are you? We're going to ask you three questions about curses from around the world. You learned about these on the website asylum.com. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice, on their voicemail. Bill, who is Jackie Joyner Kersee playing for?
Cynthia Kreider of St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. Your hometown person. Okay, Jackie, here's your first question. In Turkey, they insult rich, entitled people by saying which of these? A, you are a child of pudding. B, may your domestic help regularly look at you in the eye in an insolent way. Or C, you donate to public radio.
So there's none above, right? So
no, you're not going to answer one of the things. I'll review it.
I go A.
You're going to go
pudding.
A. You are a child of pudding. You're right. Very good. Yes. Not being Turkish, we have no idea why they say that. Next question is very good. In Portugal, you might insult a guy by telling him to do what? A, go eat at White Castle. B, go comb a monkey. Or C, go try to reform the international banking system. Those are insults, ways to send them away in an insulting way.
Portugal. Okay, B.
Go comb a monkey. You're right. Very good. Jackie, one more question. Let's go for the gold, as it were. In Iceland, if you get really angry at somebody, you can call them a prumpazen. A prumpazen, which means you're calling them what? A Bjork tribute act. B, a fart chicken. Or C, a dish of overcooked horse meat.
Oh, my God.
In Iceland?
Iceland.
A fart chicken?
A fart chicken.
So we go with the fart chicken.
You want to go with the fart chicken? Yes, it's the fart chicken. Bill, how did Jackie Joyner Kersee do in our quiz?
Another gold medal for her robe.
Jackie Joyner Kersee is a track and field legend and the founder of the Jackie Joyner Kersee Foundation and Center in East St. Louis, Illinois. Her new youth athletics program is Winning for Life. Jackie Joyner Kersee, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Most of us, even those of us who love sports, secretly don't understand what the heck is going on. That's why some of our favorite people are the announcers, especially in baseball, where frankly there's a lot of time to fill.
Speaking of filling time, here's our conversation with John Miller, legendary voice of the San Francisco Giants, who joined us in March along with panelists Tom Baudet, Roxanne Roberts, and PJ O'Rourke.
I asked him about how he learned to call baseball games so well.
I really... always wanted to do it because I was a big baseball fan, but not a great baseball player. So I bought a tabletop baseball game called Strat-O-Matic.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to while away the hours all summer long, growing up near San Francisco, rolling these dice and playing these games and broadcasting the games. And not just broadcasting the games, but I would do the crowd noise. I would be the public address announcer, the ballpark organist. I'd be the whole show. There's a base hit to left field. Dude, right fielder, Hilda. Roger Maris, yes. Number nine. This was how I spent my youth, and the great thing is I still do the same thing, I just don't have to do the crowd noise.
I appreciate that. Well, when you were doing that, did you do the occasional sort of heckling of the players that the mics in the crowd would have? I love that when that happens, when you hear people screaming at the players and it gets picked up in the broadcast. Did you do that too?
When I was first starting out as a major league broadcaster in 1974, I did the Oakland A's games, and the A's were the best team in baseball, but nobody went to see them. And we used to have people shout at us while we were broadcasting from down in the stands. Said, "Keep it quiet up there, will you, for God's sake?
Trying to watch a game." We heard that in addition to your skills as a baseball announcer, that you're known for your impressions. Is that true?
Everybody does an impression of somebody, and for me, it was certain baseball broadcasters who were very distinctive, or even public address announcers. And probably my all-time favorite, and he's passed away now, so there goes my act.
Yeah.
But when you would go to Yankee Stadium,
oh, sure.
It not only was the great historic ballpark where the Babe and Lou Gehrig played, and Mantle and Maris and all those great players and championships, but then the public address announcer would welcome you to the ballpark, and you really knew you were someplace special. Bob Shepard was
his
name.
Yes, of course.
And he'd come on and he'd say, "Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Yankee Stadium, for today's game between," and the only thing was is that Bob spoke so slowly, elegantly, but slowly, that when he'd give the starting lineups before the game, it would be the fifth inning before he'd give the
Now, one of the things about calling a baseball game, you have to make it interesting even when nothing is happening, which happens a lot in a baseball game, so we wanted to test you. Do you think you could do a play-by-play on me, say, making a ham sandwich? If you could narrate that.
Now, at the deli section in the supermarket that he frequents, there are maybe 12 different qualities of ham, and that alone can be a very daunting sort of a project, and I know that he gave it a lot of thought ahead of time, so he's got excellent ham, that's no problem. The question is, what kind of cheese to match it with? It'll be interesting to see what he's going to pull out next, because a lot of people, they just put that American cheese and bleh. But if I know him, no, this is going to be some beautiful French aged cheese. Oh, there it is!
John, we are delighted to talk to you, but we've asked you here today to play a game we're calling...
You're going to eat that?
Science writer Mary Roach, having covered sex and death already, has a new book out called Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. We're going to ask you three questions based on her remarkable book, and if you get two right, you'll win our prize, Carl Castle's voice on your home answering machine. Bill, who is John Miller playing for?
Elliot Liebson of St. Louis, Missouri.
Here, John, is your first question. For centuries, scientists have been trying to figure out how to get nutrition out of things that are, well, not food. So in the 19th century, you could try a nutritional supplement made from what? A, Peruvian seabird guano, B, tiny pebbles, or C, ground-up scrap iron?
All right, well, I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with Peruvian seabird guano. You're right. That's what they did. Back in the 19th century, there was this theory that certain animals did not digest their food completely, so you could get some use out of it after they were done with it, as it were. This turned out not to be true. Next question. Rabbis, spend a lot of time deciding what's kosher and what is not. They recently decided that what is kosher? A, bacon. B, Zima clear malt. Or C, human hair.
These questions are just so obvious, you know.
Yes.
All right, well, I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B, Zima clear malt, the now discontinued horror beverage. No, I'm afraid it was actually C, human hair. And you may ask, who eats human hair? And the answer is you do, because food processors extract a particular kind of protein from human hair that is then used in food processing.
Wow.
So isn't that amazing?
I'm amazed.
All right, now this is exciting, John. This is an exciting game, as you might say. In fact, I wish you were announcing this game, because it's tense, because you've got one for two with one to go. If you get this last question, you will win it all. Until they reach a certain age, it turns out, kids will pretty much eat anything. It turns out that cultural food preferences are not innate. They're learned. So one study found that 55% of kids under 29 months happily ate which of these disgusting choices? A, a coil of peanut butter scented with Limburger cheese and presented as dog do. B, a piping hot bowl of something they called Quaker's goat meal. Or C, a McRib sandwich.
Okay, I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B? Quaker's goat meal?
Yeah.
What would Quaker's goat meal be?
I don't know. If I was 2 years old, I'd eat it.
All right, your choice then is a piping hot bowl of something they call Quaker's goat meal. It was A. It was the coil of peanut butter. And the whole point was that you could give a little kid something called dog do, and you go, okay. That they don't learn to be disgusted by it until later.
All right. I should have had that one. I don't know what I was thinking.
I don't know. Bill, how did John do in our quiz?
He did, well, he didn't do very well. but John, you know, all these tidbits are going to come in handy during the seventh inning for you.
Yes. I actually wanted to see if you could do something. Your team has just lost. You have just lost. So if you were announcing this game that you just played and you knew that the John Miller fans at home, of whom there are many, were sad that the John Miller team did not come out with a win, what would you say?
I'd have to go with the Harry Carey idea in that scenario.
Yeah?
Oh, what was he thinking of? I can't believe it. $10 million a year and he only gets one right. Holy cow.
John Miller is the play-by-play announcer for the San Francisco Giants. John Miller, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. And the next time you have questions like that, ask somebody else.
All right. Thank you. When we come back, two people who do impossible things walk a tightrope across very deep holes and try to make a living playing soccer in the United States. Support for NPR comes from Pimsleur Language Program, celebrating 50 years of teaching foreign languages. 50 languages are available at Pimsleur.com. Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at Progressive.com. Arizona State University Online, more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs at radio.asu.edu. And CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. And once again, here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks so much. There are a lot of different kinds of pastimes and games, so there's some debate over what actually is a sport and what isn't. Here's my definition. A sport is anything I am scared to attempt.
Which is why we're including our interview with tightrope walker Nick Walenda in June of this year, just a few weeks before he made his attempt to walk across the Grand Canyon on a wire.
Along with the panelists Tom Baudette, Roxanne Roberts, and PJ O'Rourke, plus Bill Curtis, I wondered how he ever got into this strange line of work. Turns out, he was born into it.
That's correct. My family started performing back in the 1780s, so over 200 years now we've been performing, and I'm now the seventh generation carrying on that illustrious industry.
Right, yeah, of circus work.
Wearing spangles.
Well, you don't. Actually, I noticed this, that at least in the recent videos of you I've seen, including your great Niagara Falls walk, the first man ever to walk across the whole falls on a tightrope, right?
That's correct.
Right. You didn't wear a spangly suit.
I don't. Actually, I the last time I wore a spangly suit, I think I was 12 years old.
Right.
I wear jeans and a T-shirt for most of my events.
12 is a painful age for spangles.
Trust me.
So getting back to your growing up, I've read your memoir, and one of the things you talk about is growing up, how incredibly difficult it is and was to make your living in the circus. And you had to work hard. You, like, bus tables in a restaurant for years to support
That's
yourself?
That's right. I did a little bit of everything. Bussing tables, waited tables, you know, everything you can imagine.
Could you hold a lot of trays and plates?
Like... Oh, absolutely.
Now, you did this stunt. You're the first person ever to do it. You walked across Niagara Falls on live TV. And you have a tether on holding you to the wire. And we were told that you really didn't want to do that.
I didn't. You know, for generations, it's been passed on to our family that a safety device, a net, a tether, is a false sense of security. One of my great-grandfather's older brothers actually fell into a net and bounced out, and because of that, he was adamantly against them. And his thought process was, and what he's passed on, is that if you have a safety device, your mindset is you're at ease, and your thought is it's okay, we can use it.
Right.
And to answer that question, my network partner came in 2 weeks prior to that event, about 2.5 weeks prior, and said, we're not going to air this unless you wear a tether. It was a surprise to all of us. We really don't know why it came on. And I had to wear a tether, which was extremely nerve-wracking because I'd never worn one up until then. And I was more nervous that it was going to get caught on something as I was walking and that it was going to cause me to fall.
Right, because that would be scary. Now,
it would be.
Now, what's interesting to me is you're not working in circuses. You're doing stuff in buildings and across Niagara Falls and pretty soon across the Grand Canyon. So what are the dangers? I mean, do you worry about a bird flying up and getting in your face? What's the weirdest thing that's happened?
You know, I have had birds land on my balancing pole. I have been stung by a bee while performing. All of that really comes down to training and preparation. Actually, when I was younger, my parents, as I was training, would sneak up behind me and shake the wire. Of course, I was down low. But just so that they knew, they'd throw a pine cone at me. So I was distracted so that they knew that I would have enough focus to be able to stay on the wire no matter what would come at me.
So your parents' parenting skills were they'd put you up on a high wire and they'd stand there and throw pine cones at you. So tell us about, I'm really curious about this. You're going to cross the Grand Canyon. Live, we hope. And
yes.
you're going to...
We'll start out live, I guarantee you that much.
All right. You will be live at one end, and this is, how far across is it?
It's approximately 1,400 feet across and about 1,500 feet high. It's actually higher than the Willis Tower.
We used to call the Sears Tower here in Chicago. So that's pretty high, and you're going to be out there, and this time apparently you're not going to have a tether and certainly not a net.
That's correct.
And you have not lined the Grand Canyon with pillows or anything like that.
Not yet. I'm working on that sponsor.
And what is your pre-walk ritual?
It isn't anything you would expect. I'm not superstitious at all. I give my wife and kids a hug and a kiss and say, see you in a few minutes, just like I do when I go out to get groceries at night.
I don't want to know how you get to the grocery store. But really, you just say, okay, time to do the stunt.
That's right. Yeah, there's nothing exciting.
Way to sell it, Nick.
Yeah. Okay, Nick Walenda, we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
Whoops.
Not one you often want to use in my line of business.
No. Last thing you want to hear somebody like you say. Your job requires precision, grace, care. Other people's jobs, not so much. We've got some examples of extreme clumsiness, stupidity, or both, taken from an annual compilation of unusual workers' comp claims put together by lawyer Thomas Robinson. Answer two questions about these dumb moves correctly. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on their home voicemail. So, Bill, who is aerialist Nick Walenda playing for?
Kathy Lawler of Cary, North Carolina.
All right. Ready to play?
I'm ready.
All right. Here is your first question. In 2012, a woman tried to sue for an injury she sustained at her job teaching at a high school when what happened? A, she got lead poisoning from constantly chewing her pencils, nervous habit. B, she had traumatic stress from, quote, seeing how those kids dress these days. Or C, she turned and ran straight into a concrete wall when a coworker showed her a snake.
I'm going to say B.
You're going to say B, she had traumatic stress from, quote, seeing how those kids dress these days?
That's my guess.
Yeah, you have teenage kids, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, no, actually it was C, the one with the wall and the snake. What happened was is that the snake was confiscated from a student, and the assistant principal stopped by this woman's schoolroom and said, "Hey, look at this." And she went, "Ah!" and immediately ran into the wall. Her claims of injuries and post-traumatic stress from the incident were denied. However, even though that happened, a North Carolina office manager did get compensated for an injury she sustained when she did what? A, doing a classic facepalm gesture while holding a cream pie. Sploosh. B, trying to ride down the escalator rail after a big employee dinner. Or C, doing a trust fall with people it turns out she should not have trusted.
I'm going to say B.
Trying to ride down the escalator. You're right. It was a big dinner at one of these conferences. She had a lot to drink. And she, guess, decided to make like a Walenda. She thought it'd be fun to slide down the escalator rail. It wasn't. She fell, hurt herself, but she got compensated. All right. Last question. If you get this right, you'll have made it to the other side successfully. In 2009, a young worker in Illinois received compensation for an injury he suffered, and what the court referred to as an act of chivalry. What did he do? A, he chased down a coworker who he thought had stolen his office mate's salad dressing. B, he was trying to dislodge a bag of Fritos from a vending machine with a, quote, shoulder block. Or C, he was leaning out the window to release a spider the receptionist refused to let him squish.
I'm going to say B.
You're going to say B, he was trying to dislodge the bag of Fritos from the vending machine?
That's my guess.
You're right! That's what he was doing. You know how it is. The coworker, had put the money in to get the Fritos. They were hanging there in the little spiral, and he's like, "I'll take care of it." And he gives it a shoulder block, and he manages to fracture his own hip. No word on whether the coworker got the Fritos. Bill, how did Nick Walenda do in our quiz?
He got 2 out of 3. That's a percentage that does not work in Nick's line of work.
But he did win, though, didn't he?
He won. Yes, everybody wins on this show. You're 2 out of 3.
Nick Walenda is the author of the new book, Balance, A Story of Faith, Family, and Life on the Line. Nick Walenda, thank you so much for joining us. Well, I would like to tell you about my conversation with Abby Wambach, 2-time Olympic gold medalist and star of the U.S. soccer team, but I've never had one.
No, that was guest host Drew Carey. He spoke to Abby, along with panelists Tom Baudet, Brian Babylon, and Kerry O'Connor. But don't worry, Peter, you weren't forgotten.
So listen, as I mentioned, I'm a huge soccer fan, my number one favorite sport, and Peter Sagal isn't. So I guess my first question is, what's wrong with him and everyone else wasn't a soccer fan?
That's a great question. Yeah. Soccer is one of those sports that is just, it obviously is the world's game. It's the most popular sport played around the world. But I like it because you got to know your teammates, you got to know your strengths and your weaknesses, and ultimately that one goal. I know it's not the American style. Few goals is the way soccer is meant to be played. It's a cerebral game, and I really appreciate that part of it.
I think they should give 7 points for every goal so everybody else could understand it. And they'll be like... All right, 21-7. Woo! Make me really happy. About a game. Now, you've been a part of many really exciting moments in soccer history. You had a great header during overtime to beat Brazil in the World Cup. Twice you've had headers in overtime to beat Brazil. Do they hate you in Brazil?
I think so. I think that they're going to ban me from crossing the line, whether it be Olympics in 2016 or the 2014 Men's World Cup.
Yeah, didn't you win like the 2011 ESPY Play of the Year Award?
Yeah, that was
from ESPN.
It was pretty special, you know. I mean, not to mention it's against Brazil. You know, they have a tendency to sometimes, you know, go down and writhe in pain and waste time and the gamesmanship stuff. And it kind of came back to bite them because...
punching people in the eye. Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, that was Colombia. I got to get my...
Yeah, that was Colombia.
Now, what do you think you'd be doing if you weren't a soccer player? Like, because you've been playing since you were 4 years old. And I understand you had to move to a boys' team after you scored 27 goals in 3 games when you were a kid.
Yeah, my parents were the kind of people that didn't want me to get a big head, so they just kept challenging me. But what I would do if I weren't playing soccer, truthfully, I have no freaking clue. I mean, I love what I do. I'm going to play until I possibly can't play anymore, and at that point, I'll decide.
What was your major when you were in college?
You know, I was probably mostly majored in playing soccer, honestly.
Female athletes are just like the male athletes, aren't they?
Abby, this is Tom. I just, you know, as the father of boys who play sports and as a hockey dad who's up to my eyeballs in the sport, I have to say what I appreciate about soccer is the lack of equipment. This hockey bag that my 7-year-old carries around, you could put two of him in the bag. Have you played since you were just a little mite like that?
Yeah, I have. I have played pretty young, and you know, I played all sports growing up, but that's also the best part about playing soccer is all you need is a ball. You know, you can get two trees in your backyard, and there you go, you got a goal.
Yeah, now, listen, like, speaking of hockey and equipment and all that stuff, you're not wearing anything but your uniform when you're playing. And I have to ask you, you've had your share of injuries. You want to run down just a few of your injury highlights?
Yeah, I've had a few interesting moments. Broke my leg, tib-fib, have a rod in my leg now. Got punched in the face. I've had multiple stitches put in my head from getting headed by other opponents.
What is this, Fight Club?
Yeah, what was that like, getting your face stapled together in the middle of a game? Like, what were you thinking?
I don't know. It was the end of the game, and we needed to win that game to qualify for the World Cup, so I was just like, let's go, like, staple it up, you know, and your adrenaline's kicking so much that you don't really feel it, and...
Staple it up. Listen, you know, a lot of people, if they don't know soccer, they think soccer players are notorious for flopping, so you realize you don't have to go that far, right?
I do, and I think that the fact that women, and myself included, you know, if we're getting staples on the field... We're trying to make Americans know that a lot of the South American countries, they're pretty much more known for flopping than the Americans. Like to stand strong and show the American people that soccer is a physical contact sport, but we're not floppers.
Some of your teammates have made fun of you for being a bad dancer. Now, how can you be so good with your feet and be a bad dancer?
Honestly, I'm more of a big target forward, so I would actually even question my ability with the ball at my feet and my technical ability as well.
Yeah, you score a lot of goals with your head. Yeah, right.
I do. I'm pretty much brain dead at this point.
Now, I'm also a big fan of Hope Solo. If you were to arm wrestle Hope Solo, who would win?
I think she would win. She's got guns, you know what I'm saying?
So do you.
I've got the weight. I've got her on the weight category, but she uses her hands and is...
What if you each had a stapler?
Now, are you okay being around after a loss? Are you really mad? Are you good after, like, really happy after a win, really sad after a loss? What's it like?
Yeah, well, after a win, most of us are probably just, we expect to win because we've been winning for so many years. And after a loss, it's very, very quiet on the team bus ride back to the hotel. And all of us are trying to think through what happened and how do we fix this? How do we not get to this point again? And yeah, you don't want to get really close to me because I'm steaming. I'm upset.
Oh, well, the reason I wanted to know how you are after win or how you are after loss, we've asked you here to play a little game. We're calling.
You're good at soccer, but can you carry your young in a pouch?
Oh, boy. Here we go.
I'm almost glad you're not here to punch me. Your name is Abby Wambach, so it sounds like wombat, which, of course, means you'll know everything about them. We're going to ask you 3 questions about the cuddly marsupials, the wombat. Get two right, and you win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their voicemail. You ready to go?
I'm ready.
Now, Carl, who's Abby Wambach playing for?
Abby is playing for Lakshmi Shamagan of Fitchburg, Massachusetts.
Okay, Abby, here's your first question about wombats. Despite their cute, cuddly appearance, wombats have inspired some creepy tributes, including which of these? A, an Iraqi Little League team called the Saddam Bats. B, a short-lived DC comic series called Wombatman and Wombin. Or C, a fan group for the bloody video game Mortal Kombat called Mortal Wombat.
Oh, my God. I'm going to go C.
C, Mortal Wombat. You are correct. Yes, Mortal Wombat. 1 out of 3. Next question. Wombats have an amazing defense advantage. What is it? A, their butts are indestructible. B, they wear glasses. You wouldn't hit a marsupial with glasses, would you? Or C, they have a ton of horses and bayonets.
Oh, I'm going to go A.
A, yes, their butts are indestructible. When pursued, they dive headfirst into a hole and wait for the predator to bite their butt. Once he's latched on, they kick him until he's dead or loses interest. All right, 2 out of 3. Here's your last question. Let's go for a clean sweep. What do wombats and supermodels have in common? A, they both spend most of the day sleeping in their burrows. B, both take 2 weeks to digest their food. C, both are nocturnal and tend to feed on grasses, roots, and bark. D, all of the above.
I'm going to say D.
Yes, all of the above. Carl, how'd you do?
Well, Abby had 3 correct answers, so she wins our prize for Lakshmi Shamagan.
Abby Wambach, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Abby. Good luck.
Take care. See you, Abby. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to help keep the customer informed. More at angieslist.com. The National Association of Realtors, an advocate for homeownership. More at houselogic.com/homeownership. Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And Subaru, introducing the all-new 2014 Forester. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at subaru.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Emily Acton and Eva Walchover. Our intern is 4-Minute Miles Dernbos. Our technical director is Lorna White. Production coordinator is Robert Newhouse. Our CFO is Anna Nien. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. The executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks to all of our panelists you heard this week, plus guest judge and scorekeeper Bull Curtis, and guest host Drew Carey. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll see you next week. This is NPR.
On the next On Being, we're fascinated with outer space, but the bottom of the ocean is just as alien, just as mysterious.
And keeps us alive, oh, by the way.
Oceanographer Sylvia Earle has walked on the bottom of the sea, and she takes us there with singular urgency and passion. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me. That's from APM.
Join us for On Being, Sunday afternoons at 3 and again Sunday nights at 11.
Next time on Radiolab.
What is there in human nature that allows an individual to act inhumanely, harshly, severely?
Why did you do this? Why did you inflict all this suffering on them, on us? Why?
It was not my personal affair. I had to do what I was ordered.
Does everybody at some point have something dark in them that just tiptoes out, just from time to time?
Join us for Radiolab every Sunday night at 8 and Wednesday night at 10.
This is 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule of all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. It's 12 o'clock.